Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
How much do you know about tribal policing? You know, law enforcement on Native American Indian lands. Yeah, I don't know too much either. But get ready. Today we're going to learn all about this from a friend who's now a chief of police on an American Indian reservation. Here we go.
Hey guys, welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. And like I tell you every week, we've got another special guest on this week. This gentleman and I became friends here a few months ago on texting and on LinkedIn, and then actually got to meet him in person, but we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly. Can't thank you enough for coming back every week. It's you heard me say this a couple weeks ago. I don't know what's wrong with you people, why you come back to listen to me. I think it's to hear the guests, because I do bring some studs and studettes on here that you're probably not going to hear anywhere else. And we get into their personal stories, and that's what y'all seem to like. So thank you for coming back. If you're not listening to this on YouTube, I appreciate if you go over and check out YouTube and click on that subscribe button for me. I'm trying to grow the platform over there, and I can't do it without you. So as you know, I bring on heroes from law enforcement, from military, and first responders. So the gentleman I'm bringing on today is a chief of police in a Native American tribal community. This is a first for Game of Crimes. That's why I'm tickled to have him on here. So our guest is Earl Cohen. Earl, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. This is a unique opportunity to talk a little bit about a very small segment of law enforcement in the United States and maybe to dispel some myths and be able to kind of just give people an inside look into what we do. So
when I got to come up and visit you about a month ago, you're going to hear some of the same questions I asked you back then, because I knew nothing about the tribal Indian police. But
sure.
And that's what makes Game of Crime so special. We bring on the special guests. But as our regular listeners know, we have our weekly small town police blotter. And I spoke to Earl about this on sending emails back and forth, and he didn't hesitate to say, be glad to read a story. I sent him a story about a dumb criminal there in Washington State. That's where Earl's located. But then he sent me a story that's even better. So, Earl, I want to turn it over to you, buddy, and tell us about this wonderful criminal you've seen up there.
Sure. So a couple of years ago, Washington in 2021 enacted, just for some backstory, they actually created legislation for our pursuit policies. So they actually made a state law that regulated when we could pursue vehicles, right? And shortly after that,
did.
Right? Shortly after that law passed, a small town called Leavenworth. It's on Highway 2 in kind of central western Washington. A gentleman there decided that he needed to take a school bus. It was a privately owned school bus from a water rafting company there. That's one of the businesses in Leavenworth. Mm-hmm. But he decided he needed the school bus. So he stole the school bus. He was wearing a bright yellow dress at the time. So very distinctive. And if you Google search it, you'll actually find pictures. So he was leaving eastbound on Highway 2 towards eastern Washington. Chelan County deputies responded, and obviously it's a school bus, so you can't miss it, right? They attempted to traffic stop it. The bus didn't stop. Washington's new police reform laws no longer allowed law enforcement to pursue a fleeing vehicle unless there was probable cause that a serious felony, and there's four required elements that we'll get to at the end that law implemented. But the probable cause standard was interesting for us because that's a very high bar to meet for a vehicle pursuit.
Yeah.
So anyway, the Chelan County deputies backed off and let it go. Well, Douglas County deputies picked it up and they discontinued their pursuit also as it crossed to the next county over. So they were contacted here a day or two later by the Chula Police Department, who believed that they had the driver in custody and that he was wearing the yellow dress still. So
he's making a fashion statement here.
So he takes this bus. He drives this bus basically as far as he can drive this bus. And then he is able to hitchhike the rest of the way to eastern Washington. And it was his home there in Chulawa. And he went to his wife's house. And he actually utilized a front end loader and basically crashed it into her house along with the car. So he basically dumped the car on the house and then crashed the front end loader through. But anyway, it's interesting. He had recently been released from Washington State Hospital early, or Western State Hospital early, which is one of our mental health hospitals here. And yeah, he made his way all the way across the state via the stolen school bus and then hitchhiking before he was able to do that. So numerous agencies were able to locate the bus, attempt to stop the bus. The pursuit legislation at that time kept us from being able to do that. So four elements that we had at the time: probable cause for a violent offense, a sex offense, or escape from a detention facility. Pursuit was necessary to apprehend, identify or apprehend the person. The driver poses an imminent threat to the safety of others, and the risk of failing to apprehend or identify the person is greater than the risk of the vehicle, and a supervisor has provided authorization. So because of that probable cause standard, none of that other stuff really mattered, because it's really impossible to reach, you know, a probable cause standard. And then, of course, for a violent offense. And it actually enumerated the offenses in the state law specifically. So we'll tell you, Washington has kind of come to its senses now. And after a couple of legislative sessions, we have a much more reasonable pursuit law now.
Thanks.
Keeping the community safe, but at the same time, it does allow that accountability piece. So I do encourage folks, though, Google search that and steal school bus Leavenworth, Washington. It was pretty crazy. And it literally was from one end of the state to the other.
Yeah, and you sent me that article, and ladies and gentlemen, if you read that article, you'll see pictures, and you'll see how good he looks in that dress. I wonder, did he borrow that from his wife? She's probably upset about that. If I remember, too, Earl, his wife was able to get out of the house before he crashed into it, right?
That is correct. Yeah, I think she got some kind of warning that he was coming, and she was able to vacate the house before he got there. But it wrecked that place something serious. So,
you know, so had she not gotten that call, she could have lost her life. And exactly. These are funny stories, but
now, but at the time, it's a very serious matter. I mean, he was clearly on a mission to do harm, didn't care about the repercussions. And
that's I try not to go political here on this, but I just want to say this, that that's what happens when you get legislators in there that make snap decisions to cater to whatever the trending rhetoric is that's coming in at the time. And okay, you can't chase. I can understand if it's not a felony, but last time I checked, Grand Theft Auto is a felony. I'm sure that is in Washington State as well. So at what point do we let are we allowed to put criminals in jail rather than letting them run the asylum that we call our states?
Yeah. And like I said, thankfully it took a couple of sessions, but the legislators has started reversing course on some of those decisions. So
very glad to hear that.
Yeah, the communities have kind of spoken, and we're glad to hear it as well. One of the unique things about Washington, I don't know if anybody knows this, but we actually rank at the bottom 50 out of 50 for number of law enforcement officers per 100,000 people.
Wow.
Actually 52nd, because D.C. and Puerto Rico. But anyway, long story short, when they enacted all this police legislation in 21, we had a lot of folks leave law enforcement. We had folks that were just kind of one bad day, and then they're like, we're out. And so that dropped us, you know, even further. And 2024 now, so, you know, it was 3+ years ago, and agencies are still recovering from those losses of those staff. And we lost a lot of senior staff, too. So, I mean, the folks that were experienced and, you know, and our new folks. And so we're all, you know, my agency was down to 50% of our staffing. We're back up to about 80% now. But, you know, it makes it hard for the people who are staying on board. And so we were very clear with our legislators, like, this is the position that you've put us in. And thankfully, you know, they listened for the most part. It took a lot of conversations, but they finally started to get it. So
very good. Well, you know, you and I had this conversation when I was up there with you that and I won't mention the agencies here in Florida, but there are agencies that actively recruit from Washington State and Oregon State to bring law enforcement here and that experienced law enforcement officers. And they will give them a bonus, which provides them the cash to relocate their families from that side of the country to this side of the country. And if you look at it from the sheriff or the chief's point of view, they're getting experienced law enforcement. They go through an abbreviated academy here in the state of Florida to learn state laws and, you know, how the differences are and everything. And then there's no field training officer. It's right fresh out on the street. You got another experienced officer. So that ranking, instead of being 52 at the bottom, if you flip that over, that makes Washington State the leader and getting rid of police officers around the United States. That's not a good reputation to have.
It's not.
Oh, man. And thank God we got people like you and all the folks that work in your agency, as well as all the other dedicated law enforcement professionals in Washington State who stick to it up there. I don't know, especially you get down to Seattle and you know, some of the places like the bigger cities. I don't know how they operate.
Yeah,
you know, with all the
Seattle's
restrictions
down, they're down to their lowest staffing level since the mid-1960s.
Wow.
Right now.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. That's a whole different episode. I might have to bring you over on Patreon. We can just bitch about this all day long. All right. Well, thank you for that. And seriously, thank you for bringing that article on, because it was a lot better than the one I gave you. So typically, because I'm in Florida, I would bring in about a Florida criminal. But it kind of gets long in the tooth, to be honest with you, because there are so many stories about crazy criminals in Florida. And nobody knows that better than Earl, because we're going to talk about where he grew up here shortly. But I found one from Georgia. And I lived in Georgia twice in my life, stationed there with DEA. They have certainly have their share of crazy criminals. And so let me just read this one, because this one made me chuckle when I was doing the research. And it starts out, police ID suspect who wore world's worst disguise during a GameStop store burglary. So Georgia police have identified the man who burglarized a GameStop store while wearing the world's worst disguise, the plastic wrapping used to package water bottles. You know, the clear plastic wrapping. Cops report that Kerry Hammond Jr. is wanted in connection with last Friday's burglary of the video store in St. Mary's, a city in Georgia's southeastern corner. Investigators allege that the 22-year-old Hammond, certainly old enough to know better to do this, sought to hide his identity by wearing the plastic wrapping around his head. But Hammond, who is 6'1 and 275 pounds, that's a big boy, did a poor job obscuring his face, as seen in video surveillance stills released by police. A distinctive tattoo on Hammond's right forearm can also be seen in the GameStop security vest. Hammond, who was last spotted driving a white 2006 Ford Taurus, has two other active felony warrants charging him with burglary and criminal damage to property. Hammond has been dubbed Big Dasani. In Georgia. In seeking the public assistance, St. Mary's police have noted that you can help us catch him once you've stopped laughing. What a great way to end the story, right? And I saw a picture of the guy. It's ridiculous. I mean, you know how it's like the wrapping from one of the big 24 bottle cases, so how big that is. And he's got it hanging over his face, but right where his face is, it's as clear as could be. I mean, just. On this show, we call this small town police blotters. On my Patreon channel, we call this You Can't Make This Shit Up. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And again, Earl, thank you very much for the story out of Washington. That's fantastic.
Of course, yeah.
And urge everybody, go check that out, because there's stupid criminals everywhere. So just want to tell our listeners real quick how I met Earl. And as I mentioned, we established contact through LinkedIn, and Earl was holding a law enforcement seminar up in upstate Washington. We've been following each other on LinkedIn for a while. We discussed everything and thought, man, I've never been to that part of the country. I've been to Portland. I've been to Seattle once, but really didn't get to see anything. We just, you know, these events, we go in and speak and we leave. But he said, well, it's going to be in a beautiful place called Anacortes, Washington. And so I looked it up on the map, and holy cow, what a beautiful surrounding. So we flew up there. The guys, they picked us up at the airport. Just Earl and his crew treated us like family. Everybody we met there was unbelievable. Had a fantastic time. And that's a place I would go back to again, except it gets cold during the winter, and Washington is known for its rain, right?
Raining today. Sunshine yesterday, raining today.
And you know what it is here in Orlando.
Probably 86 and yeah.
Yep. Bright and sunny right now.
Right.
I even have to close the blinds here in my little office so it's not so bright. But
just keep rubbing that in there, Steve. That's fine.
Well, when you come back to visit, brother, you gotta stop by.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I'm paying for it, because when I lived there, I used to send, you know, my college friends and stuff, you know, Christmas Day pictures from the beach with it being bright and sunny and stuff. And so I'm just convinced I'm paying for that now with this weather. But anyway, we can talk more about that later.
Yeah. So what we usually do here, Earl, as I mentioned before we started recording, is that I ask you about your background, where you grew up, what your family dynamics are, if you got brothers and sisters, where you went to schools, things like that. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a few minutes here and just let you run with it, please.
All right. Sounds good. Well, I was born in Dallas, Texas. I lived in Dallas and Abilene before my family relocated to Florida. We lived in Orlando, Florida. I went to school at the University of Central Florida there in Orlando, graduated with a BS in criminal justice. Yep. Absolutely. Went through college. I did the ROTC program. My long-term goal was to become a search and rescue pilot in the Air Force. So I graduated from UCF in 2005. I had some medical stuff come up that negated my ability to get into the military service. So I went and got my ratings myself, fixed wing rating and helicopter rating through the FAA. So thank you for UCF for letting me work all the overtime to pay for that.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I very much enjoyed that part of my life and actually got to do it professionally for a while. So I started with UCF PD in July of 2024, so just before I graduated. Prior to that, I worked with them.
Wait a minute, 2024?
I'm sorry, 2004.
There you go.
It's early. Hang on one second. Let me get a...
I know what you mean.
So July of 2004, so just having finished my 20th year. So that's when I went to the academy. Prior to that, I actually worked in their police records division as a student assistant and an employee. So that's what I did for work while I was in school. So that gave me a unique perspective into law enforcement from the backside, right? Being able to, you know, read all the reports and process all the things, build relationships with the officers, kind of, you know, figure out that, okay, this is where I want to start my career since I can't do this other thing. So went to the academy for them, got sponsored through the academy for them. And, you know, had a really, really great time working there, spent, you know, time working patrol, was a training officer, was a community relations officer. And then one of the other unique things I got to do is once I became, you know, a licensed helicopter pilot, I had an opportunity to join up with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. Their aviation unit is a joint unit with all the agencies in the region. Agencies contribute officers to that unit to help staff it. And then it's a benefit, right, to everybody in the region, right?
Wow.
As she behind me, I was able to do that professionally for a while. Had a really, really good time with it. A lot of fun. And so I didn't get to fly in the Air Force, but, you know, we did some pretty cool stuff with the helicopters, chasing bad guys, doing, you know, rescue missions, doing fire suppression, things like that.
Well, not to mention you're getting hours there and getting paid to get your hours.
Yeah, exactly. When somebody else is paying the gas bill, that's a nice thing. So
yep.
It was a lot of fun.
I worked when I was a city cop back in the 70s. My partner, well, not partner, but my best friend, he and I started taking lessons to get our pilot's license. And back then it wasn't that expensive. It was expensive for us because we weren't making a lot of money. But during training, when they took me up to teach me how to come out of a spin, I'm not kidding. I about crapped my pants. It's one of the, it may be the most scariest thing I've ever done in my life. When we got back, I said, you know what, I'm done. I'm not going to pursue this any further. It just scared me that bad. And my buddy, he went on to get his license and eventually became an executive with American Airlines. He's retired now, lives in Dallas, as a matter of fact, right outside of Dallas.
Nice.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask you, before we go any further here, at UCF, what police academy did you go to? They don't have their own, do they?
No. So I went to, at the time, it was Seminole Community College's Criminal Justice Institute. I believe, I'm not sure, they renamed it to a state college now, but it's located right there in kind of the Sanford-Castleberry area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I went and got my certification.
And that includes everything from classroom to physical training to
classroom,
firearms.
Classroom, physical
everything.
Training, defensive tactics, firearms, you know, emergency vehicle operations, all the things. As a matter of fact, the current sheriff of Seminole County, Dennis Lima, was one of my academy instructors back then.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm going to try and get him on here at some point.
Nice.
He was former Orlando Police Department, too, wasn't he?
I'm not sure. I think Dennis was a sheriff's office guy. He was a sheriff's office guy in 04, so I think he might have been.
Okay. So probably was a good part of his career there.
Yeah.
I got to meet him at the Blue Line Gala last year here in Orlando, which is the main fundraiser every year for Orlando Police, Seminole County, Osceola County, and Orange County Sheriff's Departments.
Nice.
Great people. Great people to meet there.
For sure.
And before we continue on in your career here, how did you choose law enforcement? What was the attraction to go into law enforcement? Is that family thing or?
So it was a family thing, but it was, it is a family thing. So I've got my great grandfather, and then an aunt who are all former law enforcement, two for the city of Pittsburgh and for the Pennsylvania State Troopers. So I did have one kind of going back generations. But for me, the search and rescue pilot thing was kind of the first step. And then I eventually figured, hey, when I retire, I'll go fly for law enforcement. And so I kind of skipped that part and went flying for law enforcement.
Yeah.
So it was eventually part of the plan the whole time. But when it was plan B, it became plan A. And that's how life happens sometimes, right? You know, like I said, having the connections within the department, working in the department, I knew what I was getting into. Mm-hmm. Had great relationships with everybody there and had a really great time working
there. Did you start college first and then become a cop or vice versa?
Started college first. I started at UCF in 2001. And then I got picked up working in the police department in 2002, originally as a student assistant. And then, like I said, working in their records division and then eventually being sponsored to go to the academy.
Yeah, cool. Where did your dad work? Was he Pittsburgh PD? We're talking about Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, Pennsylvania. And it was my grandfather and my great-grandfather. They were both city of Pittsburgh.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
Yep. So,
very good. But you didn't want to go up north, huh?
Something about the cold and the rain and the snow, but then look where I ended up. So
you said it. I was going to say it, but you said it first.
Yep. So
regular listeners know I'm just not a fan of that.
Having
grown up in high school and college in West Virginia, I had my fair share of cold weather and snow. It's
beautiful, absolutely.
But it's beautiful from a distance too.
Yep. Yep. So,
Very good. So
like I said, the family connection for every generation, there's been at least one of us. So.
That's pretty cool about the becoming a helicopter pilot for law enforcement. That's intriguing. I've gone out on, when I was with DEA, you're doing surveillances up in fixed wings and helicopters. And tell you what, just that never once was enough for me doing that because especially if you're in a fixed wing, you're flying figure eights or circles.
Yes.
And I get sick and I never threw up, but a lot of guys did. But you come back just feeling like crap. There's no excitement in it for me. So I was always happy when somebody else would want to volunteer for that. But you still maintain your ratings and you still have your license?
I still do hold my license, but financially, with my family obligations now, two kiddos, the lack of expendable income is keeping me from maintaining, you know, currency and everything. But still a great part of my life. Hope to get back to it eventually one day, just because as people who know about flying know, once that bug bites you, it doesn't let you go.
Yeah. I'm glad it didn't bite me. I take my hat off to all the pilots out there because I didn't have the stones to do it. That's not me. I can do a lot of other things, but not that. So now you grew up you're from Texas, but you really grew up here in Orlando.
That's correct.
But from Orlando, you went to with staying inside the continental United States, you went about as far as you can freaking go, which is not warm. It's not dry. It's not sunny a lot of days. How in the world did you end up in Washington State?
So, So my wife was also a UCF graduate. She went through the nursing program there. We met in college. And while I was working at UCF, she was working for what is now Orlando Health as an emergency room nurse down there.
Yeah.
And one day she said, you know, I think I might want to look at going back and being closer to family. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Let's go check out Washington. So I was like, okay. So I came out there in May, which is beautiful. It's beautiful out here in May, you know, blue skies, everything's green. You know, when I got here, when we finally decided to make the move, I moved in December.
And
it was December of 2009, which was one of the worst winters they had had in a while. So the Florida kid who had no experience driving in snow, you know, they have these things here they call mountains. As you know, Florida does not have those.
Well, we have them. We call them curb.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it was quite an adjustment learning to do all that. And of course, you know, I was able to lateral to a police agency. So that was really great to be able to come into a position there. But learning to, you know, drive a rear wheel drive Crown Vic and all of that was interesting.
Yeah.
And it was an experience making that change up here. So
you learn how to walk that. You learn how to walk that cruiser up a hill in snow using that steering wheel, don't you?
Yeah, it was an experience.
And you got out there. Well, first of all, let me just say, God bless your wife, but I think she baited you by taking you out there in May.
I agree. It wasn't in the brochure. Was not in the brochure. This December weather was not a thing.
Which just goes to show we married women a lot smarter than us, didn't we? She grew up there in Washington State?
That's right. She grew up north of Seattle, a little town called Mukilteo. Washington, which is right up on the Puget Sound.
Gotcha. So you get up there, and now you didn't go right into an Indian tribal community. You went to another police department, right?
That's right, yeah. So when I was looking for work up there, not a lot of folks were hiring at that time. There was kind of a surplus of applicants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied for a couple of agencies. In the city of Issaquah offered me a position. That was Chief Paul Ayers at the time. And so I jumped on it because I wanted to get out there, wanted to get work in. And so I worked for City of Issaquah for about 6 months. The schedule was a little crazy. My wife was on a fixed schedule and we were on our rotating 8-day work week. So our days off were kind of crazy and we never saw each other and not having a support system. And I also found that there were some stark contrast differences between university policing that I had done and city policing, particularly in a different state. Washington is very different. They have, only Fourth Amendment protections that all of us have in this country. They have Article 1, Section 7 of the Washington Constitution, which further provides additional constitutional protections, which are great for the good folks. It just makes our job as law enforcement a little bit harder to mm-hmm. catch the criminals. So doing all that adjustment, not seeing her and everything, I said, you know what, I need to take a break and find something that's more my speed, more my style. And so I left the city of Issaquah. Chief Ayers made sure I was able to get through the Washington State Equivalency Academy to transfer my certification. So I'm very grateful to him for that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not a lot of places were hiring at that time. So while I was in the Equivalency Academy, I actually met a gentleman that worked up here at Swinomish. He was also in the Equivalency Academy. He had come up from Oregon. And I was like, hey, tell me a little bit about that. And it's interesting, in the working on the reservation paralleled a lot with university policing. And we can talk more about that here in a little bit. But it mm-hmm. became an attractive opportunity. And I said, I'm going to look at that. So I went ahead, put in my application. I was in the hiring process for a couple of months and then was able to eventually join as a patrol officer. And that was in January of 2010. And I've been here ever since. So
nice. Nice.
Yeah.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
You mentioned the Equivalency Academy. So you had to go through a law enforcement academy in Washington
That's
State?
That's right. We had to go through like a 2-week abbreviated academy. They updated us on criminal procedure in the state, the various differences. And it was interesting because we had folks from New York City, Philadelphia, Detroit. Mm-hmm. I mean, all over the country, Arizona, Chief Rod Covey, formerly of the Port of Seattle, was in my equivalency class. He'd be another great guest for you to talk with. Yeah, it was interesting because we were all just like, wait, what? You can't do what? You can't do that here? The instructor's like, hey, don't shoot the messenger. But, it's a little bit different. And if you work in Washington, you understand what I'm talking about. If you don't work in Washington, it's interesting. It's interesting here. It's different. I mean, it's much more of a chess game in law enforcement up here than it is in other places in the country.
And of course, I'm talking out of school here because I've never worked up there. All I know is what I read in the media. And of course, if the media publishes, it's 100% true, right? No, it's not. But it seems like not only are you battling the criminals, but you're having to battle the lawmakers as well.
Sometimes. I think we have to educate them so that their decisions have an equal view from both sides of the coin. And like I said, I'm thankful to the representatives up in the northern districts here that we actually do have the ability to sit down and mm-hmm. have had the time to sit down and have good good conversations where they're actually listening to us and taking account into what we have to say. And, you know, it's I'm thankful because not everybody in Washington is lucky to have, you know, good reps that are willing to at least sit down at the table with you and have those conversations. So,
yeah. Yes. And you're exactly right. I know a lot of cops in California, and when a legislator will take the time to ask for input, they're ready to give it. And not that they're being confrontational, but it's bringing in a more practical, realistic side of the equation, because it's easy to sit around and make laws about things you know nothing about or that you've never participated in. But when you go out there and actually do a ride along with a uniformed police officer and see what it's like. And I just to tell you a very quick story that you can relate to. When I was in college, I was a police officer and I was going to college on the side. This was in West Virginia at Bluefield State College. And there was a female student in a class that was married to a defense attorney in town and, you know, knew him very well. We went up against each other on some felony cases. And she and I would get in debates in some of our criminal justice classes. She was very, I don't say liberal-minded thinking, but she was about 180 degrees opposite of my thinking. And so I challenged her one day. I said, look, we've got a ride-along program here in the city. Why don't you come out and ride patrol with me one night? Back then I was in my early 20s, and I guess she probably was too. She might have been a couple years older than me, but she did come out and ride with me. And we're talking small-town West Virginia, so it's not like you're going call to call to call. You had breaks and, you know, you get to teach her about patrol, but then got a fight call at one of the, you know, local beer establishments and go up there. And a lot of people think only thing cops want to do is put people in jail. And that's not necessarily true. You know, you do want to stop violence, that type of thing, protect others. But sometimes this is in the 70s, 1970. So this is when police officers still had a lot of discretion. And if you're not sure what the term discretion means, that's just being able to discern right from wrong. That's an easy way to remember what discretion is. So we're up there, and the guy, you know, got out. They had stopped fighting by the time I got there, so I didn't see any assaults. But he is one of the guys that's extremely irate, and he's calling me every name in the book. And I'm just telling him, sir, you need to calm down. If you don't, I'm going to arrest you for creating the disturbance. You know, and there's a challenge there. But, you know, finally he did calm down. He realized I was serious. And so I didn't have to put him in the jail. And so we got back in the cruiser to clear the call. And she's like, I can't believe you didn't put him in jail. And I said, what was I going to put him in jail for? She said, well, the way he was talking to you. And I said, have you ever heard of the First Amendment? I mean, that's the First Amendment of our Constitution. He can say what he wants to. You know, it's called freedom of speech, you know. And so the whole point to tell you that whole story was when we got back to class, she did a 180 on her position of law enforcement because she had actually seen what goes on. And she realized, hey, the cops that are out there are there to help people, and they're not out there to beat people up and be thugs. So let me tell you, there's times you want to be, but you take that oath and you got to live up to your oath.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting you bring that up. And if you don't mind, I'll just segue into one of these things here. So. You're absolutely right. That 180 image of law enforcement, me coming into a Native community when I started here, I was fighting that on two fronts. And where I'm from, we call tribes clans. That would be the Scots-Irish. So not Native American, right?
Right.
And two, there is a historical distrust of law enforcement and the government in general amongst the Native American tribes, thanks to the United States government and some of the things that were done, you know, over the past years. And they're working through that now. But you're overcoming multiple things there in addition to, like you said, the commonalities of looking at law enforcement from most folks. So it was almost like a triple threat, right? Having to figure that out. It made it really interesting my first year here.
Yeah. And I want to get into that a lot deeper here in just a second, but I do want to go back because I've been through two law enforcement academies myself. I know there's always, a lot of pranking going on. There's a lot of funny things that go along. And I'd like to give you an opportunity to tell us about some of those events. And in the DEA Academy, if you do something the instructors don't particularly care for, we would have to write everything down in a memorandum. So you had to write a memo, you know, and you don't like it at the time, but what they're doing is they're teaching you how to write the government way. So did you ever have to do the equivalent of writing a memo?
Oh, yeah. Many times.
Anything you want to share with us?
Yeah. So there was one incident, and it ended up being a Dear Chief memo, if anybody knows about those. It usually starts with Dear Chief. No one was more surprised than I was when this happened.
Absolutely.
So I remember the Florida kid learning to drive up here in the snow and the ice and whatnot. So I was driving home from work one day and working night shifts, and we work 12-hour shifts here, and I was working about an hour away. So it was a 14-hour deal if we didn't end up with any overtime or anything, right? Or you just end up shooting with your guys at shift change or whatever. So I was driving on home, and they use sand on the roads up here sometimes to give you some traction. Well, driving the rear-wheel Crown Vic, I was going home, and I got a little bit too close to the edge. And as you know, the rear-wheel drive Crown Vics, they will spin easily with that. And so I remember drifting over, and then all of a sudden I felt it start to go, and I was like, okay, EVOC training, how do I fix this? Well, I think I did like three revolutions, and by some miracle, the rear end of the car actually went airborne over a ditch. The reason I know that is because I was stopped in the road. One of the wheels was actually bent out from the inside from impacting the side of that ditch as it was coming back over. So yeah, I was lucky. I think there was a little guardian angel kind of holding up the back end of that car as I was spinning around. But it was funny because a deputy had just passed me going the opposite direction. And so I'm sure, you know, when I stopped, finally, I was facing the opposite way I was going, and I see his blue lights down there. And I'm sure he just saw me, you know, headlights, taillights for a second. And he came back to check on me. And I mean, I was, I almost crapped my pants on that one. But hopefully, in the grand scheme of things, it was just the rim of the car got bent. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely those, you know, and it's like, oh man, am I going to get fired? You know, am I going to explain this one? And
yeah.
So yeah, it was the Dear Chief memo, and 20-year career, you end up at least doing a couple of those.
Oh yeah, it's never a comfortable feeling. When I was a city cop, I wrecked, I think, three that I can remember, and then one we were chasing a couple guys that had pulled an armed robbery, and I mean it was fresh. They were trying to escape the scene, and I rammed them head on. I was driving a Crown Vic. Well, they were driving a big Cadillac DeVille or Seville, whatever was popular back then, a big hoopty car. And we hit head on. I hit them head on, and they kind of bounced my Crown Vic out of the way and kept on going. And we finally got them stopped. But even when it's intentional like that, it's still not comfortable to have to go into the captain and say, sir, I wrecked the car, and this time I did it intentionally.
Yeah. See, what had happened was, no, but even as a chief now too, I look back and accidents happen, things happen. So I tell my guys, you know, hey, if you weren't throwing around, you weren't being stupid, you weren't doing this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a cost of doing business, and we'll deal with it.
Yeah.
Be honest with me, tell me what happened, and let's work through it. Right. So, I've in 20 years had good leaders and had not so good leaders. I really try to emulate the good leaders for my crew.
Yeah.
So
I'm just sitting here thinking about my wrecks, and I was in a high-speed pursuit one night, and, the guy came. He actually went on these back streets and ended up behind the state college there where I went to school. So I knew that area very well. And
yes,
and you could see him coming up, and he hits a tree, and he's going to bail. And so I thought I hit it in park, and I'm bailing out, getting ready to run after him, and didn't quite hit park all the way. Kind of hit neutral. He went down, ran through a fire hydrant.
So you just reminded me, I had an incident almost exactly like that when I was a patrol lieutenant. So one of my guys, he hopped out with a sexual assault suspect, and we're on an island. So there's only two ways off the island, right? Two bridges. Mm-hmm. And so he calls out with this guy on this bridge, and I'm like two blocks away. So I'm like, and over there. And as I'm driving onto the bridge, I see dude start to take off, and he goes hands on. And so I'm like, you know, I'm up there real quick. Well, I had a hybrid Ford Fusion as an admin car. And those hybrid Ford Fusions don't have a traditional gear shift. They have a little twist knob.
Okay.
And so I thought I twisted the knob all the way to park.
Yeah.
And so I hop out, jump on this dude. We get him restrained, you know, on the radio. And I turn around and my car is gone. And I look down and it is just slow rolled in drive, but just neutral. And thankfully, some folks on the other side of the bridge, they had stopped seeing us fighting. Well, one of the guys actually hopped out of his car, ran and hopped in my car and put it in park.
Oh, nice.
And so awesome that he did that. He actually, the guy he was riding with, got the whole thing on video and ended it up on TikTok, and it may very well be on YouTube. But he at least sent it to me first and said, hey, do you care if I do this? And I was like, man, no, you saved my car. And I went to our legal folks at the time too, and I said, you know, hey, I had a near miss incident, and they said, well, you know, you guys were doing the right thing, and you were helping your partner out, and so, you know, if it would have been a bit of thing, we would have dealt with it, but
Yeah.
You know, yeah, just that panic moment of like you look back and your car's gone.
You had a guardian angel that night.
Yeah. Yeah. Couple of those in my career, I feel like. You know, so
yeah,
if I find that video, I'll send it to you.
Oh, yeah. That'd be good. That'd be good. And I might post it on YouTube. You never know. No,
right?
I wouldn't do that to you. I wouldn't do that to you. So you got married. You told us you got some kids here.
Yep.
And I won't ask for names, but how old are your children now?
So I have two daughters, 12 and 9. So one is a sixth grader and one is a fourth grader.
Very good.
Yep.
And let me tell you, by the time they get to be teenagers, your hair will be like
mine. I'm feeling
mine.
It already.
Way
I'm feeling
on back,
it already.
Bald spot back here.
The preteen angst is a real thing there. So I feel bad for my wife because they are, you know, she's a daddy's girl, but they are just like all the time. So, it's something.
It brings back memories, and I'm not going to say they were all good.
Yes.
So now you're up in Washington State, and you're leaving the Issaquah Police.
Mm-hmm.
And did you immediately go from them to the, I call it Swinomish, but I heard you just pronounce this a different way.
Yes, Swinomish. So the O in there is actually pronounced like an A.
Okay. And I've been saying it wrong for over a month now.
That's okay. It's a funny story about that. At my swearing-in ceremony, the tribal senator that swore me in, the oath, and I said it how you said it, and he kind of brings me in, gives me a hug, whispers in my ear. It's like, hey, it's Swinomish. And I was like, got it. So ever since then, we've been good.
So what was the, you're not Native American.
Correct.
So what was it? Was the attraction just that there was a job available, or was that something that you were always interested in? How did you get into that?
Initially, it was talking with my buddy from the Equivalency Academy and kind of hearing about, hey, what's policing like up there for you? And the parallels to university policing were very similar. A small community. It's very much self-sufficient. It's got, you know, residential areas just like a college campus. It's got services and programs and, you know, we've got, you know, a housing department. We've got a social services department. We've got, you know, a medical, dental, you know, you've got everything. I mean, it literally looks like a college campus up here with neighborhoods interspersed, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a natural fit in that regard. And also community policing is huge for a couple of reasons. One, you have to rebuild that trust or build that trust with your community if you want to be an effective law enforcement officer, which working on a college campus, you had to learn how to do that, right? College mm-hmm. campuses generally are not the most law enforcement friendly places to be, right? So it was a natural parallel with that experience coming into Indian Country policing. The thing is, you know, small department was unique to me in the sense of, you know, in Florida, you got cops tripping over each other. When I first started working here, there was a 4-hour block on night shift that I was it for the entire reservation. And there were two of us before that. So you probably, you know, remember that from back early in your career. You know, this was 2009, 2010. And when I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm it for the next 4 hours. You're just hoping nothing bad happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you get a DV call and,
DV.
You know, the closest domestic violence. That's right. Sorry. We talked about the acronyms.
It's okay.
So I'm working by myself and I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to this by myself. So I call a deputy for assistance. And starts heading that way, and I'm waiting. Well, I had waited at the last turn off on the main road before you had to go down three back roads to a house that you couldn't see the address in the dark of night. And he got there, and he's like, man, I'm so glad you waited here for me, because I would have never found you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And ended up taking care of business and doing all the stuff. But it was definitely an adjustment coming from a place where you called for backup. You had folks tripping over each other to get there to, you know, hey, you're on your own for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And what that did is that really made you good at talking to people, especially if you unviewed something or something mm-hmm. like that. You really learned to use your words. And, you know, one of the things that I dedicated myself to and spent a lot of time doing was building relationships with our local folks here, because sometimes they are your closest backup.
Yep.
And that's the thing about small town policing is the guy you arrest one day could be saving you the next day.
Yep.
So those relationships are very, very important.
They absolutely are. I've had instances when I was a city police officer where you're in a residential neighborhood and you're there maybe on a noise complaint during a party, and you end up in a fight, and backup's going to be 5 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
But I can think of two instances right off the top of my head without even having to think a lot, where we got each other in headlocks and neither one of us could do anything. And I'm trying to keep him away from my gun.
Yep.
And I had one of the safety holsters. So if he didn't know how to get it out, he wasn't going to be able to get it out. And it never came to that. But you're just hanging on for dear life until help gets there, when luckily neighbors would come out and they're like, Mr. Police Officer, do you need some help? Hell yeah, I need help.
Exactly. And there have been a couple of times here where that investment has paid off, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and then we would always honor them with some kind of public proclamation. The chief and the mayor would come out. And it's nice to know that your community supports you. And that little apartment I worked on was only 35 people, so it's not like I think we had back then. It might have been between 20 and 25,000 people in the town. So, but I, as you were talking there, I wanted to back up. I forgot to ask you, when you were at University of Central Florida, what are the responsibilities of a college cop? You know, what's your responsibilities? What's your territory, your geography, all
so
that? What's your state authority?
So for us, we were considered state officers. So we had authority within the college campus, and we also had authority on the bordering roads to the college campus for traffic enforcement. And we also had several off-campus residential properties, so apartment complexes that the university bought that were considered student housing. So we were responsible for all law enforcement in all of those areas. And of course, you know, worked really well with our county partners that, you know, the areas in between there. But yeah, we went through the same state academy as everybody else, had the same authority, had all the same computer systems and all that stuff. And
were you on a common radio frequency with them?
So no, we had a our own central communication center. We were on our own frequency, but our comm center could patch us and of course monitored the surrounding because we were actually on a county line. So we had Orange County and Seminole County. And our fire station that was closest to us was a combined station of Orange and Seminole County too.
Really?
So we worked pretty well, like I said, with all those folks. And, you know, I've still got, you know, friends there that you know, I've had lifelong relationships with that are still working both at the university and Seminole County. But it was, you know, your usual law enforcement stuff. But the extra stuff that we did, ran a program called Adopt-A-Cop, where we would bridge gaps with sororities, fraternities, you know, student housing communities. And we would just go there and hang out with them, you know, spend time with them, you know, coffee, play Xbox, you know, just building those relationships because we really wanted those students to understand we're really here to keep you safe. We're really here to help. We're really here to, you know, to do all the things that you don't necessarily think of us as doing. Like you said, we're not just about taking people to jail. We're not just about beating people down. You know, do we do that? Yeah, sometimes it's necessary, but it's not the core of the job. And so, you know, we had a real successful program with that. But the other thing is, you know, hey, we're still doing, you know, vehicle lockouts. We're still doing, you know, professors locked out of their office. Guess who they call? You know, at night when we had to go, you know, certain buildings would close, we'd have to go do that, or we'd have to do building checks. So like the chemistry building or the biology building. So really became almost like you're a law enforcement officer, but you also kind of have that force protection mindset for the facility as well. So you're kind of doing that security role in a lot of places as well.
So my oldest daughter, she graduated from Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, which is the college is right downtown Richmond. It's on the edge of the hood. There's some challenges throughout the campus with people that come and sleep in parks and things like that. And VCU has, I think it's almost 100 police officers on their college department. It's one of the largest university police departments in the United States. And of course, when we went to orientation, you go into the main room and there's all the different departments and everybody that, you know, history, chemistry, everything's in there. And the first one I go to is the police. And I started questioning because I know Richmond. Richmond's a tough town. And then the lady that I spoke with, she put my mind at ease. She's like, look, we're this many strong. We're, I think, the second or third largest in the United States. We have common radio frequencies, communications with Richmond PD. And I'd already been through that whole area, and you saw RPD everywhere, you know, so it made me feel better. But they also had a program where if a student, especially at nighttime, was not comfortable, they had an app on their phone where they could call, and a university cop would respond and take them to their dorm or their housing.
So when I first started at UCF, we had that program, and it was, you know, background check students that would do that. That was my first year at the police department. So we had passenger golf carts. And we would get, they'd call the police department and say, hey, need a ride from here to here. We'd go take care of it. And we ran from, you know, 8 o'clock at night till 1, 2 in the morning. But that was huge for a lot of folks. You know?
Oh, yeah. For the parents, let me tell you. It gave me a huge degree of comfort knowing that they were available. And, you know, you always make sure your kid had that app on the phone. Everything was good. But when you guys were doing, I love it that you're going out and meeting the students and not in an official capacity. You're just going in to meet them. What was the response from them? Were they receptive or were they suspicious? Or
I think it was a mixed response, really. Really kind of, I think, depended on where they came from, what their previous experience with law enforcement was. But it was I would say, overall very positive once they kind of got to know us. And would be assigned like to the same housing area, right? So I had the Lake Claire community. So I got to know all the resident assistants, got to know the housing director over there. You know, through that, got to know some of the students. And so you really got to know those folks. And then, of course, they're there for 4 years, right? So as they go through, those relationships continue, word gets out, and you just, you know, you really have an opportunity to really be impactful.
And that carries on into their life because they've had a positive impact or a positive experience with the police officer. And that just does volumes to maybe change their attitude as they grow up and become more responsible in their lives and become older.
Absolutely.
Did you guys have the authority to work a murder? Okay, so you worked all felonies. Nice. I know when I was, I went from being a city cop to a railroad cop and then DEA. And while I was a railroad cop, we had state jurisdiction in West Virginia and Virginia, but we did not have authority to work capital cases.
Gotcha.
So if it was a, and, you know, thank the good Lord, it wasn't, didn't have any murders to deal with, but kidnappings, things like that, you called in the locals. But I think every railroad cop I ever worked with was a former uniformed police officer. And so you were intimately involved with the investigation as it goes on.
Absolutely. We have a great working relationship for our area with Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad Police. We had a train derailment here a couple of years ago and got to know some of those guys pretty well during the response for that incident. So
how many officers did they have at UCF?
When I was there, we had just north of 50, and I believe they're up over 100 now. Yeah.
And my first police department was 35. So they got a bigger university police department than they did the town that I was working in.
Yeah, my current authorized sworn, I have 12 patrol and 16 total sworn. So it definitely is where I came from. And here it's like, wow, this is something different.
Yeah.
But it's perfect size for what we have. You know, jurisdiction's not growing. We're not annexing. We're not in a city where we're going to be growing. So, you know, we're the right size for where we are. We have a lot of, you know, specialty units and opportunities that you can't necessarily find in bigger departments, or you're going to be waiting your time in bigger departments to do. So that's, you know, an attractive recruiting thing for us. But yeah, it was definitely adjustment coming from Florida. Yeah.
Not just weather-wise.
Yes.
And I'm going to get into that with you here just in a few minutes. Hey, players, that's the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guests, book lists, merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. I'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.